sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Russia spooks stocks. Amazon also spook stocks, finally seeing some disapproval after a spending spree that they're going on even more than they have in the past. We're going to look at peak earnings for the S&P, lots of economics, and our guest John Markman. All this and much more on episode number 361 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome aboard. Andrew Horowitz here, and it's the last week of April. And the year is kind of cruising along here. Next week, of course, we're going to have the big numbers from about 200-plus companies that are going to be reporting earnings. We have some economics that are coming out. And we're going to see some of the rhetoric and information from the governments around the world talk about sanctions. The G7 did put sanctions on Russia. At least they talked about it. And what's interesting about that is if you looked at what happened last week, about a week ago or so on Sunday, well, we saw that John Kerry came out with this announcement, hey, whoa, we're so excited. There's going to be this Geneva Pact and Russia's going to de-escalate and all this. Nothing of the sort, my friends, has gone on. You know, actually, when this announcement came out last week, I tweeted, I said, oh, come on, really? I was really wrestling with this whole idea that how easy it was for the G7 to make this resolution and to Russia go along with this after all that has been going on and all the buildup and all the posturing by Russia and the violence that's going on in Ukraine and all. And I was like, what? Is that really what's going on? I mean, it doesn't seem likely that Russia's just going to back down like this. And, you know, you scratch your head and wonder, what is it with these politicians that they just constantly are throwing out information that is bad, just poorly devised information to hopefully what? Bring our spirits up of some sort, to try to twist public opinion in order to get politicians of other countries that they don't have control of to do what they want. It seems to be, you know, kind of this trend that's going on. I don't know where it started exactly and when it's going to end. It's inclusive of what's going on with the Fed, with their commentary and their quote-unquote communications policy, which is nothing more than the old days of propaganda and rhetoric in order to shift your opinion on the outlook in the future and to keep your spirits up. You know, all this combined with some of the headline numbers that you see when it comes to earnings and economics, you have to really step back, take a breath for a second, look deeper into the information like we always talk about, and really step back and see what's going on. For example, you know, you take a look at what happened with Amazon last week. Amazon stock initially popped after the earnings came out. There were some numbers that were better. Revenues were definitely better. But one of the things that I picked up, I said, wait a minute. They're forecasting a $450 million loss potentially in the next quarter. Wow, that's a big number. That's tremendous. I think that there is some real interesting dynamics that are going on. Obviously, Amazon wants to spend in order to build up their overall delivery platform to make it not only very much efficient on the next day for their Prime, but also same day. They've talked about drones. They talked about, you know, instantaneous delivery. I don't know if this is jumping the shark and if this is getting beyond the level of what is really beneficial, but it took an entire after hours and into the morning until Amazon started turning and people finally voiced their disapproval by selling the stock with the amount of expenditures and the spending spree that's going on. Facebook also saw a pop initially when they came out with the earnings, and they started drifting lower because the fact is their metrics were not keeping pace with their growth that they had in the past. Yes, the earnings were better and things are looking better, but you know what? There is this continual belief that things are getting better. But if you look at the growth trend on some stocks, you have to say, wait, what's going on here? Now, I'm going to save some of the questions I have on peak earnings and outlook to our discussion with John Markman, but I thought it was really interesting that some of the things that we're seeing right now and the headlines that we're seeing are really encapsulating only the good points, but if you look deeper into the data on some of these stocks and some of these names and some of the economics, there's really some cause to be concerned right now. We saw the housing numbers last week, right? We saw a 14% drop in new housing sales. That is a tremendous drop off. And, you know, this is something where, if you remember a number of weeks ago, I had talked about this. I'm concerned about the spring selling season when it comes to new housing. And I had a really good source of this. Even though we did see that some of the numbers came out better in terms of earnings from a variety of companies in the housing sector very recently, the outlook, obviously, that they are projecting and the rosiness that most people are looking at when it comes to the housing sector may not be justifiable right now. I would take a look at some of these stocks, whether it's D.H. Horton, whether it's Lennar, whether it's KB Homes, Hunvavian. Take a look at these and see if their stocks really look like the chart is showing an upward trend that will continue or a continuation of the downtrend. We're also seeing that there are spotty real areas of concern when it comes to tech. Microsoft, of course, we saw that did better. We saw Apple clearly just blowing it out, selling an amazing amount of phones in the world. The iPhones a little bit light on their iPads, and every other metric looked really decent overall. The big news, though, was the 7-for-1 stock split, the increase in the dividend that they're going to have, that they're going to continue doing by about 8% and over time, and the fact that there is the potential for them now to be included in the Dow, because after the 7-for-1 stock split, they have much more of an ability to be in the Dow if they're chosen to, because of the pricing and how the price-weighted average of the Dow Jones is formulated. Couldn't have a stock that was $500 or $600 in there before. It would just totally skew the weighting of the index. And now, of course, you look at the stock that's going to be 75 or 80, whatever the number is, when it actually splits, and it is much more, quote-unquote, affordable for the average investor. Does it make the stock any cheaper? No. Does it change any of the fundamentals? No. But what they're doing is they're increasing their buybacks, they are splitting their stock, and they're increasing their dividend. Those three things really are dramatic and different than what we've seen before from Apple, as well as the fact that their earnings were respectable. There's nothing wrong with their earnings overall. Propelled the stock about 10%. Very impressive. We'll get to some more of this in a little bit and talk about what's going on this week when it comes to earnings and employment and economics and all those good things, and kind of get into the details of what to expect moving forward. If or not, this is a point of rolling or another range-bound trade. You know, Mother's Day is coming up. I don't know about you, but I kind of want to be the favorite child, don't you? So what better way to keep that going and to tell Mom how much I love her and that I respect the fact that she put in all that hard work to not only bring me into this world, but also to help me grow up and teach me and to be there for me and always to be my biggest fan. And you know what I do? I'm going to send her a dozen, maybe two, maybe I'll send her two. Two dozen roses, rainbow, just all sorts of different colors from Pro Flowers. And I'll tell you something. I recently bought my wife a gift, and it was very easy because all I did was just go on to Pro Flowers, and I clicked around. I bought the roses, and they shipped in the next day in a great box. You get this fantastic glass vase, and it's just $19.95. I mean, you could be a hero for $19.95. In fact, if you want to double it, you get double these roses. You get the full two dozen, plus you can get chocolates for just $9.99 more. Mother's Day is coming. So all you have to do to get this special order is go to proflowers.com, click on the blue microphone in the top right corner, and type in investor. That's proflowers.com, and you click on the microphone, and just make sure to put an investor in there. This deal is going to expire soon. Make sure you order it today, and you can, of course, set it for the date that you want it to be delivered. And you could be the hero, you could be the favorite child. Even if you're an only child, you'd be even the more famous and favorite and absolute love of the life of your mom for doing something like this. You know, and then you can probably go out to her and take her out and maybe even go and have a little brunch or lunch. And she's going to tell everybody about these great flowers that you got her, because you're special and she's special. Proflowers.com. All right, with my good friend John Markman from Markman Capital Insights. And I wanted to bring him aboard because he's just a treasure trove of information, all sorts of information about markets and history. He's written some great books. He has some great products out there for investors. Information sources, a fantastic writer. John, how are you?
Fantastic, Andrew. Great to talk to you.
Hey, thanks. Listen, I wanted to talk to you, and I have a lot of things on my docket to bring up, but I thought we'd start with what the whole shenanigans that's going on in Russia. And, you know, why is Russia this whole issue that kind of comes and goes, and it flares up, then it dies down, and why is it affecting our markets, and why is it important to understand this? Or is it?
I think that what's really important to understand about Russia is that Vladimir Putin, the former KGB agent, is trying to reorganize the former Soviet Union and by acquiring certain parts of eastern Ukraine, including, of course, the Crimea. But what's important for American investors to understand is that it doesn't really matter. Of course, we all have feelings about whether, you know, what borders certain countries should have. And obviously, the Obama administration has made it a cause celeb. But it doesn't really matter for U.S. Companies. The U.S. companies just don't sell enough into Russia to make a big difference, certainly don't sell enough into Ukraine. But it's even more than that. You know, U.S. investors are very narcissistic. They just don't care about other countries. So although issues may flare up from time to time, such as the sovereign debt crisis of Europe, Cyprus or Greece or Iraq, certain news elements like that will spark up from time to time and cause a bit of a kerfuffle on Wall Street. At the end of the day, investors have to realize that it doesn't matter to U.S. stocks.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing is that you talk about we don't really sell that much into Ukraine or any of those areas. And frankly, you know, I don't remember the last time that I went and oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. The shirt is made in the Ukraine. I'm buying it. I mean, I've never seen any kind of import that we're really getting from there either, except for maybe some commodities. Maybe.
I don't think we as Americans are really capable of understanding where the borders should be drawn in Russia or Ukraine. And right now, it's really a territorial battle between those two areas. It's been, you know, a very fluid line over history, and you know, to say that we have a really good understanding of where those lines should be and which people should ally with which government, it's just foolhardy. And frankly, I just don't think it's important.
But why does we'll finish up on this. Why does the, I mean, we know there's some natural gas issues there also, but why is the Obama administration, I mean, is it just that every single time there's a fight around the world, we have to go in and do something?
Well, you know, it's very common when the U.S. economy is struggling for a president to reach overseas to make statements, to take action that will attempt to boost his approval ratings. And I think there's a large part of that right now.
Yeah, because, I mean, we saw that again Friday. But I think Friday was more of a – I think Friday really – there was some Russia involved there. But I think with all of the economics that we saw and all the earnings that we saw last week, I mean, we saw that housing was abysmal in terms of new housing starts. And we saw that, yeah, Microsoft did well. Apple did well. A variety of companies were struggling. Amazon was just a unpleasant disaster because I think finally there was the disapproval of investors on their money spend. What do you make of what that whole situation was with Amazon?
Well, you know, investors have been very positive on Amazon for a long time because it's one of the few companies that truly dominates its space. You know, imagine if McDonald's was able to dominate had more than 45% of all restaurant market share in the United States. It would be preposterous. And yet, Amazon.com does almost 45% of all e-commerce done on the web. And e-commerce is the fastest growing, you know, really trend, you know, in American business. So it deserves a premium on some level. But the question is, does it deserve a 100x premium, 100 times earnings? I think that's a bit much. I think investors are going to come to realize that, you know, even though it does dominate, and it has done, and Bezos has done a phenomenal job of building the most compelling a new company in America in the last 100 years, it still does not deserve 100x multiple, probably more like 50 or even 35.
It's even actually a little bit higher than that right now, I think. If you look at the past trailing 12 months on it, I mean, it's probably trading more like 150, but depending on what metric you use. I know that you have an intrinsic value calculator that you use, right?
That's right. And, you know, the value of companies swings from well below intrinsic value when people are pessimistic about a company to well above intrinsic value when people are very optimistic. And right now, Amazon is trading at around $325 a share. On an intrinsic value basis, we estimate that it's really worth $75.
Wow.
So, yeah. So it can come down quite a bit just to be in alignment with its intrinsic value. And if people become very pessimistic about the growth of the company, feel like it's overspending or whatever, it could go well below that.
Wow. We've seen that. It's not abnormal. We've seen, for example, Netflix was a great example of looking at what happened with a company that had an incredible growth spurt and was really taking over the area. I mean, there was really no competition for a while. And, when they went from their, first of all, from their delivery to their streaming, and the company just went crazy, and then the stock just imploded. And then it came back a bit when the realization was it wasn't so bad.
Well, the reality is that companies that have really great businesses attract other people into that business. You know, it's very hard, very, very difficult to maintain high margins in a business that does not have many barriers to entry. And Netflix was certainly the victim of that. And going forward, Amazon could be the victim of it as well. Now, there's a lot of companies that are trading well below their intrinsic value right now, famous ones. We think IBM, which is trading, where is it right now? I don't know where it closed, but
190, round number.
Yeah. We think that's worth $375.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it based on earnings? So, is it based on breakup value or combination?
A combination of all those things. It's a company that people don't have very high hopes for. It's a company that people are very pessimistic about. And, frankly, IBM has given people a lot of things to be pessimistic about in recent quarters. It hasn't really grown very much. But the value is there. So, over time, a company will rise up towards its intrinsic value. And we think IBM, although it doesn't look like much right now, could easily go up another 50% over the next 2 to 3 years.
It's interesting because I'm kind of on the pessimistic camp from IBM in the respect that when you look at IBM and you look at their been basically a serial disappointment in terms of revenue growth, which has been, dropping, and the fact that they have been all about increasing their EPS through share buybacks, shrinking their float, issuing dividends. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine a company that has also increased competition, seeing that kind of move, except for the fact that I do agree that obviously if you do take the breakup value and the core components of what their, the balance sheet, et cetera, if you throw that in, then obviously there's a boost to that overall outlook.
Well, if you look at it a little deeper, Amazon with its 100x multiple, 150x multiple, only has cash flow per share of $7.70.
Right.
IBM, in contrast, has cash flow of $20. So, IBM is actually a much better company, and it's a much cheaper company. But Amazon happens to be the flavor of the month. It's flavor of the past 3 or 4 years. But, opinions will change, and I have no doubt that Amazon will trade down towards its intrinsic value over time.
Interesting. Let's talk a little bit about earnings since we're talking about this and what we're seeing right now in markets. In general, I think that maybe it's due to the fact there was unlimited liquidity for a long time, possibly because there was a change, obviously, since the depths of the lows of earnings growth and negative earnings and problems with companies and all the things that went on back in the 2008, 2009 time period, 2010 in a bit. Do you think that there has been too much forgiveness by investors to some of these more growth-oriented names that have really been just sluggish at best in terms of growing their bottom line?
I think in general, people overvalue growth. It's interesting because, we're taught as investors to look for companies that grow, and, the ones that grow the fastest are supposed to be the best. But generally speaking, by the time that everybody has the same opinion about growth, it's usually overvalued in the stock. It's already in the stock and overvalued. So, you know, we really don't think that growth should be investors' number one criteria when they're looking at stocks. We think that people should look at value first. You know, look at stock. If you just have to use one criteria, you know, look for stocks that have low PEs relative to their peers, not relative to their own history, but relative to their peers. And then after you find the ones that are cheap on that basis, then look for ones that are growing. So, you know, in summary, I would say that while a growth at a reasonable price is the mantra for most growth investors today, we think that a better way to go is to look for value with some reasonable growth.
Yeah, is there an acronym for that?
You know, I haven't come up with a good acronym for it. Maybe VERGE, value with reasonable growth instead of growth with...
VERGE, that's good. VERGE, and then you can kind of extrapolate. It's on a verge of a breakout, on a verge of a turnaround. That's a good one.
Yeah, so that's my thought for today. Look for value with reasonable growth rather than growth at a reasonable price.
Well, the other thing that you'll get with value, you may, let's be honest. The fact is with value, you may not get the kick. You may not get the big move on a regular basis like you see with some of these stocks that are growth-oriented. And just pick your poison, whatever that name is. But at the same time, you know, when things really hit the fan, you're not going to see the enormous, unless something really weird happens, you're not going to see that enormous sell-off. I mean, just look at IBM. IBM has disappointed the last couple of quarters. What did they go down? 4%, 5%, 6%? It was nothing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, really. But you see that that somebody sneezed over in Russia, and you see that, you know, Facebook comes down 8% or whatever the number is, right? Twitter.
There's no intrinsic value there. I mean, Facebook is worth, I don't know, maybe $30, something like that.
Yep, my hit parade is Twitter.
I misspoke. Well, Facebook is worth, according to our system, about $14.
That's on intrinsic value. Obviously, you have to look at what the potential is, but I wouldn't say it's so far from that either. You know, don't forget that if we have a short memory as investors. Remember the name MySpace and some of the other, you know, the names that were out there in the past that were the number ones. In their area. And I mean, Facebook has obviously it has utility. It has, if nothing else, is a giant phone book and a place where you can keep organized all your different contacts in a way. I was kind of curious about Twitter. You know, a lot of people look at Twitter and they look at Facebook and they're like, oh, Facebook has done so well and Twitter maybe do so well in terms of monetizing their mobile and all that. And one of the big things that I just taught a class at high school recently, a one-day little thing, and talked about like the differences between a Facebook and a Twitter, and they you know, they really can relate to this. One of the things about Facebook is when I asked the question, "Hey, what does Facebook know about you?" They all said the same thing: everything.
Yep.
And I said, "Well, okay, let's kind of go over now and look at let's look at Twitter. You all have Twitter accounts, so many of them did." I said, "Well, what do they know about you?" Not much. I mean, to set up a Twitter account, you need maybe an email and your first and last name, maybe. That's it.
So, well, one of the things that Facebook did right from the very beginning, and it's gotten to be controversial, but they require you to have a real name. It's one of the very few websites that requires you to use your name. You know, you can't be, Super Andy 1000, like you can't be at Twitter.
Right.
You've got to be Andrew Horowitz in order to get an account there. And they put a high value on knowing exactly who you are and presenting yourself in that way to people. But there's a lot of, there's a big movement amongst the public, which says, wait a minute, you know, I give up a lot of my privacy. I give up too much of my privacy when I'm required to use my real name on Facebook. And so I think you're going to see that erode. That's the Facebook's stance that requires you to use your real name. I think you're going to see that erode over time, probably over the next year and a half.
It's interesting because, you know, as we know, you do have a choice, right? You don't have to use Facebook. You know, I mean, it's not necessary that you use Facebook. I mean, you can. You have benefit if you do. But, you know, isn't there the opportunity to just, if you don't want to disclose your name and your information and all that, just to simply not use Facebook? I mean, is that something that is even in the realm of possibility, or is that just so far-fetched that, you know, nobody's going to even think about that?
No, I do think that it's very likely, in my opinion, that people will get tired and will get bored with Facebook over time, and also recognize their the fact that they're giving up a lot of their privacy, and just stop using it. But you know, the fact is, it's right now it's got a huge legacy amount of legacy information. I mean, people have loaded information in there and their timelines, you know, for, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 years. So you can't just, it's very difficult to pick up and move that or migrate it someplace else. And I think that's really their greatest strength is just, customer inertia.
Yeah, I hear you. Let's kind of shoot across. We were talking about earnings, and I want to kind of go through that again.
Can I just say one thing about Twitter?
No. Of course you can. Right. What?
You know, I think Twitter is actually an interesting play. I actually like Twitter a little bit more than Facebook.
Really?
Because, yeah, I think that Twitter is going to do a nice job in the coming world that we've already seen of streaming entertainment. Because, you know, one thing that we can say with certainty is that people are changing the way that they acquire entertainment. You know, with Netflix doing its own shows, Showtime and HBO shows more popular than ever. You know, Yahoo talking about doing its own shows, Microsoft talking about doing Xbox shows. Basically, you know, a lot of the talent that used to go into just programming or, you know, creating sites with utility are now going into creating entertainment that people can access over their tablets and their laptops and whatnot, mobile devices. And I think that Twitter is unusually well-suited for people sharing information about their television or their online viewing experiences.
All right, let's kind of let's segue over a second. We talk about, for example, some of this intrinsic value, but what about earnings when it comes to, for example, some of the S&P? Now, let me give you some numbers here and some things that I find interesting. You know, we clearly have seen that earnings have been growing over the last several quarters, you know, since the down and all, and we're seeing that the projections are for it to continue on this pace. But, you know, over the last several quarters, there was some, you know, very, I would say, lackluster growth in terms of the overall S&P 500 in terms of their earnings. And if you look out and you look at the projections, I mean, they're still looking for a 6 and 7% growth, but the comps are going to get a little bit more difficult because we're starting to see that in the third quarter of 2013 and the fourth quarter of 2013, we saw that the comps were a bit easier, and we saw 3.5% and 5.5% growth. But we're seeing that, you know, these kind of numbers that we're looking at, they're expecting to see 8 or 9%, but the earnings aren't coming in that well in terms of growth, are they?
No, and there's a variety of reasons for that. I mean, we all know about the China slowdown, but, you know, the fact that in a lot of multinational companies, and I'm talking about the Procter & Gambles and Kimberly-Clark's and Coca-Cola's of the world, you know, they do depend for a marginal growth on the emerging world. In the emerging world, you know, consumers are just not growing as quickly as had been expected. They got over-leveraged back when their currencies were more favorable. And now the growth overseas in emerging markets is really anemic, and it's impacting the earnings of some of our large companies.
Do you see that as something that is going to be affecting? I mean, I looked at Coca-Cola's growth rate, and it is kind of the lowest it's been in a number of years.
Well, yeah, I mean, Coca-Cola has an inherent problem in that it sells a product that has no real value of its own. And so it's highly dependent on marketing. It's highly dependent on persuading you to buy something that has no true value to you. And it's been largely, you know, very successful at persuading people to accept that product, the Coca-Cola brand, the Diet Coke, et cetera. But it's having an increasingly difficult time persuading people overseas to take the product, and I think that's really where Coca-Cola's lackluster growth is coming from.
But, you know, what I'm seeing, John, is that Coke, for example, is the last quarter was a negative 4% year-over-year growth on their earnings, and that's the lowest we've seen since 2010.
Well, are you buying more Coke than you used to in your house?
I don't think so.
Are you buying 4% more growth, more Coke?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Probably your Coca-Cola habits are established and you're not buying a lot more. So, you know, companies like Coca-Cola have to go out and, you know, acquire other companies to tack on their growth. So, for instance, Coca-Cola went out and bought a company called Vitamin Water, which is a colored drink similar to Gatorade, which tastes terrible.
A colored drink. I like that. It's kind of water with some color in it.
It's got some color in it. It's got some, like, so-called nutritional value. That's why they call it Vitamin Water, which is just everyone knows it's BS. But they're buying that company. They bought a company called Odwalla a couple of years ago, which made energy bars, really, really good set of energy bars and drinks, and then completely ruined them by adding sugar and marshmallows and things like that. And you know, the Oddwalla brand, which had been growing, you know, something like 40% a year up until the time Coca-Cola brought it, is now flat to negative for the company. So it's Coca-Cola has a lot of issues of its own that are harming it in the marketplace. But I think that strangely enough, investors are actually appreciating Coca-Cola today because they can, although their earnings growth was a little bit lackluster in the last quarter. They can be relied upon for at least 2-3% growth going forward. And in a low growth world, you know, that's not so bad. Add a couple of percentage points of yield, and you know, you're almost at 6% expectations of growth of price growth over the year.
You know, it's interesting because I did look at the dividend yield of S&P and various other components of stocks recently, and I was actually pretty surprised at how high they are right now. Yield is pretty impressive.
Yeah, you know, so if you're getting a 3% yield, and you want to get all you want to get out of your stock portfolio is, let's say, 7-8%. If you're getting a 3% yield, you only need a company to grow 5% over the course of an entire year.
Exactly,
it means like you know, you buy a $10 stock, and you only need it to go to around $10.75 by the end of December.
Yeah, no, that's exactly. Exactly.
I mean, I said that all you really need to do to be as wealthy as Warren Buffett is to buy $10 stocks. It'll be 12 by the end of the year. How hard can that be?
Right. Yep. But, you know, at the same time that we look at some of the S&P 500 and maybe the P/E ratio of the total is about 16.5 right now or something of that nature, you know, if there is the question of, are we getting towards peak earnings here? Because one of the things that companies did, as we know, they've done an incredible job at really making things efficient. You know, they've gone out and they've restructured technology. They've really done a great job on their balance sheets to make the cost structures of financing various things very good. They've done buybacks. They've done all sorts of things in terms of their overall business structures to make it as efficient as possible. Now, this, some of this stuff is new, right? I mean, some of the efficiencies are things that weren't there before. You never had, so that's a good thing. But are we entering into a peak earnings cycle, do you think?
Well, I think peak earnings is behind us, actually. But I would never denigrate or, I would you know, be cautious about expecting that companies will stop being able to find productivity increases and efficiencies. You know, I think if one thing that is going to continue is that companies will continue to find ways to financially engineer their stocks, you know, whether through buybacks or increasing dividends. We're going to see companies continue to push down their costs through a variety of methods, such as, you know, the whole cloud-based software or software as a service model. You know, as an example, I was talking to a company earlier this week called ServiceNow, symbol of NOW.
Yep, NOW, sure. They weren't taking too well on their earnings just last week.
Well, you know, their earnings were, I mean, their quarter was terrific. They sold a lot of units. But you know, they're a cloud-based company, and so all cloud-based companies are suspect by association right now. But the reason I mention them is that, you know, they are a really supercharged help desk for companies. So in the old days, when you were working at a large company, let's say at, you know, Coca-Cola, and you're a line worker or a sales manager or whatever, and you're having trouble with your in information technology, you would call some guy on a help line and he would help you, and it'd be very inefficient. And today, a company can contract with ServiceNow. They'll put in an incredibly efficient and well-managed help desk in place and help companies save literally millions or tens of millions of dollars a year on their information technology spend. So, you know, I think that those kinds of efficiencies are still coming, and you're going to see a lot more of them going forward. So at the very least, I think you should not say, "Wow, companies have found so many productivity increases, they're not going to find any more." That's not true. They're going to find a lot more.
So, but that also assumes that we have a consistency in revenues and sales, and if at the same time we are, I guess the big question is going to be whether or not the essential flat line of sales is going to continue, and if so, the efficiencies will, of course, be beneficial. But what happens if we do see that this slowdown in China, which used to be much more of a concern, by the way, it seems not to be as much of a concern anymore. Remember when China would have some bumps in the road, you know, we would kind of really get slammed pretty good. But these days it's like, well, just add more stimulus.
I think it's coming. I think it's coming. People don't really recognize how slow China is going to go over the next couple of years. You know, it's not like it's going to have negative growth or anything, but you know, they overbuilt to such an unbelievable degree. And the new government, and you know China very well, you know it better than I do, you know, the new government is really focused on exposing all of the corruption of the past government. And although, you know, they're never going to go as far as they, you know, they would in a free country, you're going to see a much larger than expected slowdown in economic growth as the new leaders try to crush the shadow banking system.
Yeah, and listen, we know that the best profession, the most lucrative job in China forever has been to be in government. They're more millionaires and billionaires in government than anything else in China. And obviously that's where the corruption has stemmed, and to really tamp that down is going to be a pretty big job. But in terms of the overbuilding, they, you know, for years we were talking about the ghost cities, and that just hasn't even been a topic at all recently. And the only stimulus we've seen is a little bit of railroad, possibly, you know, opening up some loans recently and changing the reserve requirements of banks. But at the same time, the allowance to, you know, speculate on homes and what went on in China was pretty amazing. And the fact that there was the corruption, for example, with the import-export numbers that we saw, the questionable economics. I mean, you know, for a long time, nobody was
and on top of all that, of believing it. And on top of all that, the demographics of China are horrible. You know, you're going to see a real slowdown in the growth in the or even negativity in the birth rate, just like you've seen in Japan. You know, the one child rule is going to turn out to be, you know, China's Achilles heel.
And the other thing is, I'll mention, I think that we do all recognize is that there's a lot more competition. You know, China was the place that we would go to get all of our things made and, you know, to get the cheap goods and all that. But, you know, you have countries around the area that have, you know, really started to play into that, whether it's going to be, you know, like a Vietnam, parts of Indonesia. You know, you can kind of name all these countries that are really picking up a lot of that business.
There's another country called the United States, which is picking up a lot of that business as well.
Yeah, where is that?
It's somewhere between Maine and California.
Yeah, okay, exactly. So they big country,
yeah.
Big country, lots of people, lots of technology, lots of opportunity. I think the other thing is that talking about, I think some months ago we talked about how you had a belief that we're starting to see a little bit of a top, or there was a top in the market. What's your opinion these days on where the market and valuation lies in terms of the, you know, S&P, Dow, NASDAQ, et cetera?
You know, I'm not just a big bear or anything. I just feel like, you know, we've had a five-year bull run. Bull runs are usually around 5 years. You and I were the beneficiaries of one of the most unusual bull runs in history, which was from 1982 to 2000. It's extremely unusual that a boom should last that long, and there's a lot of historical reasons why it did, including the growth of China. But the more typical bull cycle is for a bull move to last for about 5 years, and we've had that, and I think we're just ready for a cyclical downturn, and you're already seeing that in earnings. So nothing to really get that upset about. You know, if you're a long-term investor, just sit back. Wait for prices to get all lower, and you know, when they've reached the cyclical low, get ready to buy again.
And since you're talking about the average time periods of a bull cycle and, you know, normal types of things, although we're not in the normal type of things in terms of the amount of money that's being pressed in, who knows what Europe's going to do and come up with some cockamamie discussion of quantitative easing. But when you do see a 5-year bull, which is the, you know, this type of, you know, historical average, what is the next stage when you see the downturn? How long does that last?
Bear markets actually last a lot less time than bull markets, just like you've experienced. You know, when stocks come down like twice as fast as they go up. And if you don't believe that, look at, you know, some of the high flyers like Splunk, SPLK, or Workday, WDAY. You know, they took about 2 years to go up, and they're taking about three months to go down. So yeah, a couple years, a year and a half at most.
Right, and then you know the end, you'll know kind of the end where you see that. That grand few moments where the volume just explodes and you see greater movements down, and that's oftentimes where you see, hey, you know what? You can find the last guy on the street finally said, I'm done.
Oh, yeah, right? Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the bull markets start not when the first guy buys, but when the last guy sells.
Right, and exactly.
We certainly saw that in March of 2009.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have a variety of different things that you do. You know, you have newsletters out that are awesome. You can get free newsletters. We'll put it on our website how to get that. You have a couple of those. You have some portfolios that you run. I think, and I don't really know much about it because it's pretty new. You have something called, is it New Tech Superstars? Something
yeah,
like that?
I mean, it's going to sound kind of funny concerning my the attitude that I just expressed. But yes, I've just started a newsletter called New Tech Superstars. It's published through the Weiss Group. And what we're really doing is looking for some of the great new tech stories that are emerging, even though the broad economy is tapering off. And I've just released my first new pick for that service, and I don't mind talking about it right here. It's a company called NXP Semiconductors.
Mm-hmm.
NXP Semiconductors is a spinoff of Philips. The big electronics company in the Netherlands. It went public with this spinoff in 2010, and it's it kind of went flat for about a year and a half, and it's moved up about 50-100% since then. But I really think that NXP has a fantastic growth opportunity ahead of itself. I really think that we'll think about it with the same reverence as we do with Texas Instruments. They have a tremendous patent catalog. And they're in all the right groups, including making chips for cars, for dashboard cams, they make some of the most important chips in the iPhone and in the Android devices. They make the most important chip for identification purposes. For instance, in the new Eurozone passports have a little chip in them, and NXP is the company responsible for that one.
Hmm.
And where the United States is going to that same system, and NXP obviously is going to clean up. And the most important thing about NXP is that it's relatively cheap. It's got a intrinsic value is quite a bit higher than where it is right now, and I think that it's a company that has the opportunity to maybe triple or quadruple over the next 8 to 10 years.
Interesting. And the symbol is NXP.
That's right. And by the way, I do like a lot of the cloud-based companies, the Workdays, Splunks, WageWorks, ExamWorks, things like that. I like them a lot. I think that this is definitely the wave of the future. They're just overvalued right now. So what I'm talking about with my readers is saying that keep an eye on these companies. These are the next Microsofts and Googles and Amazons of the world, but they have to get cheaper before people are going to come in and buy them. And when they do,
so many of these are also takeover targets. Let's be honest. I mean, there's so much economy of scale in terms of, you talk about ServiceNow, for example. You know, you think about a company, whether they will sell or won't sell, but you think of a company that has a great amount of service, like Microsoft as an example, right? The service desks and all that, and they're in all these different companies. I mean, I'm not saying that's the exact fit, but
I mean companies like IBM can buy these guys. Certainly, Oracle can buy them. Hewlett Packard can buy them, and they will. A lot of them will be acquired by these larger firms.
Interesting. Now, one of the things I
want to make sure that people understand that when I say the next Microsoft or the next Intel, people have to put themselves back into the mindset of the late 1980s when Microsoft came public, or even early 90s. People did not have personal computers on their desk. Most people did not know what an operating system was. Most people had never used a Word or any word processor. These were all completely foreign ideas to them. So if you look at something like a ServiceNow or a Workday and you say, I don't get it, I don't understand what they're making, that's okay. It's okay for you not to understand it. It just means that it's new. And it's my job to explain what's new and is likely to continue to grow. That's my role, is to help you understand these new technologies and why they have a lot of applications into the future.
You're like an undercover detective of new tech in the future.
That's right. I mean, it's so easy to go back and say, I should have invested in Microsoft. I should have invested in Amgen. Well, you didn't have the knowledge back in the 1980s when those companies were getting started that you do now. And so you just need more knowledge to understand why a Workday or a Splunk or a Varonis, VRNS, is valuable now and will be a lot more valuable in the future.
One of the things that you do, John, in a lot of your letters, you talk about, let's take a look at where the support is on a particular stock. And one of the things I think you do differently than I've seen before is you use some kind of sometimes crazy moving averages. You know, sometimes when you look at the things, you think, well, what is he using that, 12-day, 22-day, or whatever number it is? Whereas usually you see, a 10-day, a 50-day, 100-day, maybe 150, and 200. 50 being and 200 being the most often cited in terms of what money managers are looking for and where the bounces come from, et cetera. We saw that bounce on the 200-day for the NASDAQ a couple of weeks back that was pretty strong, right?
Yeah.
Why do you use, and what's the benefit of using a moving average that's fitted to a stock?
Well, I think that most companies have constituencies. So they have money managers who are their largest holders, and those money managers have unique approaches to when they're going to buy more of a stock on pullbacks. So when money managers, let's say that the largest holder of a billion-dollar company is a hedge fund that has maybe 10% of the stock. Well, when that hedge fund gets more money in from new investors, they have to put that money to work, but they're not going to just randomly put the money to work on any the day that they receive it. They have their own theories about exactly how big a pullback they're waiting for. And so you find that small to medium-sized companies have these constituencies or these large holders who work on their own time frame, and it's up to us investors to figure out what those time frames are and sync up with them. So it may not be the standard 50 or 200-day. It might be the 70-day or the 80-day or the 90-day. But when you average all of those rhythms together, and then you look at a index in aggregate, yes, the 50, the 100, the 200 days are valuable. But when you talk about an individual company, no, you need to look at its own pattern.
Hmm. So you'll come up with, is there any particular one that you will start with?
You always start with you look at it and you try to, there's a number of ways that we have of determining what the right moving average is on an automated basis. But anybody just using stock charts on their own can figure out how to fit a moving average to a stock. And it might be the 75, it might be the 80, it might be the 30, whatever it is. What you want to do is look for all the times that a stock has come down and touched this moving average and then bounced. And if it's more than, if you have an average moving average that's hit more than three times, then you probably have something. So the advantage of knowing that is that when it hits that average the fourth time, you know that that's probably where it's going to be bought. And if it isn't bought at that time, then you know that you have an opportunity to short it there, or at least use a stop if you already own it.
Interesting. John Markman from Markman Capital Insights. Great information as always. We'll put all the links on this web on the show notes of this particular episode, so you can grab his stuff and, of course, grab all the information you can from his great books in the past that he's written. You're working on a book? You're always working on a book.
Yes, I'm working on a book about panic.
Panic disorder? Panic in the markets?
panic
at the disco, the band? What are we talking about?
Yeah, it's a book about panic, and what we're trying to do is to explain why sentiment is the most important factor in the market, and how to understand where to sell buying panics and how to buy selling panics.
Right. So we're talking about the parabolic move in either direction, and when, how to identify that. Was what you're saying, right?
Exactly. And we're looking to understand that on a fractal basis. So you can have panics on any scale, whether it's the 10-minute scale, the hour scale, the daily scale, the weekly scale, the monthly scale. So we're creating a unified theory of panic.
Wow, interesting. It's going to be very interesting. Panic. I like it.
Thank you.
Very cool. I hope to. When do you think it's going to be out?
It should be out by the end of the year.
Wow. Great. Good stuff. Panic by John Markman. I love it. All right. Listen, we'll talk to you soon, buddy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you, Andrew.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It's always good to have John with us and bringing us all sorts of good insight. He has a lot of great writing talents, a lot of great research and market insight as well. And yeah, glad he's a friend and someone I could talk to on a regular basis. I wanted to bring up some of the topics that are on the docket for this week. And we have some things in the housing market. Of course, at the end of the week, we have the ever so large looming economic data, which is the employment report. But let's kind of go through some of the things you need to be aware of real quickly for the end of the week. And we also have the key earnings announcements that will be on the next several days, which we're going to talk about in a moment. But that list of what to expect and their recent changes by analysts are all on the disciplinedinvestor.com. You can check that out at any time. We put those up on a relatively regular basis throughout the earnings season. There's about 250 companies of interest that are reporting this week, so you need to take a look at that. Before we get to that, let's talk about the economic data that we'll be seeing. And we're going to see the pending home sales number at 10 o'clock in the morning on Monday. The survey is looking for about a 0.7% increase from the last month, and that was down a bit. On a year-over-year basis, we're looking for about a drop of 10%. So we'll see how that looks. Then, of course, we have the Case-Shiller numbers coming out on the 29th. On Tuesday, we have the 20-city month-over-month is the one we watched. It looks like there's an increase of 0.7%, a little bit of a slowdown since last month, but still climbing nicely over time, and that's good to take a look at. That's on a seasonally adjusted basis. The composite looks like it's going to be up 13% on a year-over-year basis, and that's pretty impressive overall. We're seeing that move to the upside for housing prices has been continuing. Good to see that. We're also going to see on the 30th, and that's when things get a little bit more complicated, the ADP number when it comes to employment, and they're looking for about plus 206,000. And this is the private payrolls, and that usually has a pretty big bearing on expectations for 2 days later, which will be the employment number from the BLS, the official number. But we also have things like GDP annualized. This is going to be the first quarter of 2014, and we're looking at about at 1.2%. Let me take a look at that, make sure I'm right here. 1.2% on a quarter-over-quarter basis. And that drops from about a prior number that we saw. The final number was 2.6%. So this is going to be an important number to take a look at, and we're going to see how the economy is really faring, if, in fact, we can keep up with the potential for a 2 to a 3% GDP rate. Personal consumption looks like it's going to drop a little bit, but then we're going to be seeing the also in the afternoon on the 30th, this is important. We're going to see the Fed is coming out with their announcement on the pace of Treasury purchases and the pace of bond purchases. Overall, it looks like there's going to be a drop of $10 billion per month, which is what is expected, down from $55 billion to $45 billion. And we're going to have a rate decision, which we know is not going to be a decision at all. It's going to be 0 to 2.25%, and still keeping those rates very, very low. But the markets will be volatile into that. I would expect that on Tuesday, we are going to see a good amount of, Monday and Tuesday, a good amount of paint on the tape. In other words, they're going to see that the end of the month is here and mutual funds / money managers, hedge funds, want to do their best to bring their prices up because, of course, at the end of the month, they oftentimes charge their fee. In addition to that, ahead of the both the numbers on employment, and also, probably more importantly, the Fed, which is coming out at the end of the month, the last day of the month. That's an important number to look at. Oftentimes, you see that there's a lot of optimism going into a Fed speech, Fed meeting, or any kind of announcement. So we're going to see how that plays out, even though there is a lot of, probably a lot of tailwind for the downside from last week. But since we haven't seen anything major play out over the weekend, I would see that we're going to probably have some buyers bidding things up at least around the edges in the beginning of the week and probably towards the middle of the week. Then we're going to be seeing Thursday initial claims about personal spending. The GDP PCE deflator is going to be coming out. And let's just kind of go right and skip right to what we're really looking at is total vehicle sales. Estimates 16.2 million annualized. Pretty impressive on a total, and 12.8 on a domestic basis. Very impressive. ISM manufacturing is going to be out also on the first, 54.3, which is a bit higher than last period, which was 53.7. That had been dipping for some time. I'm really curious to see what the manufacturing numbers are going to play. But here we go. On Friday, we're going to be seeing the unemployment rate, and it looks like estimates are for 6.6%. It's currently at 6.7%, so they're thinking that's going to drop down a little bit. Hourly average earnings on a month-over-month basis look to increase by about 0.2%, and we're going to see the overall number that is change in non-farm payrolls. Expectations are in the 200s, 215,000. Last period was 192,000. So we're going to finalize the week with that, and we're going to be looking at really what's going on with the economy and the expectations of folks on what's going to be going on with the Fed. Now, very quickly, let's take a look at some of the important earnings that will be coming out over next week. It's interesting to see that we have a lot of names, a lot of tech, just a lot of names overall, but Herbalife is going to be coming out on the 28th after market, $1.29. They're expecting, of course, we know that there's a lot of concern around whether or not this is a multi-level marketing Ponzi slash, you know, whatever the fraud is being perpetrated here. On looking at about $1.2 billion for the quarter. Pretty impressive number if it actually gets to that point. Also looking at, let's see, Sprint will be coming out on the 29th as well. I'm trying to look down this list to see if there's anything major that's coming up here that's in the beginning. Ultimate Software, actually a local company here to us, is coming out on the 29th after the market, 40 cents on $118 million. Panera Bread on the 29th, $1.52. I'm probably going to be say that there is going to be some concern due to pricing of certain parts of their products, but we'll see how they can play out. eBay, $4.29, 67 cents on $4.2 billion. Twitter, this is going to be a big one, looking for a loss of 3 cents on $241 million of revenue. Now, I'm pretty interested in watching what's going to happen with 3D Systems on 429. Expectations of a plus 15 cents on $145 million. If you watched any of the companies in this area, this 3D printing area, it's been pretty ugly overall. And I don't know if we're going to see anything that is going to change right now, but I can tell you one thing, that sentiment is pretty low, and I would watch for the potential to see a reversal if things do play out pretty nicely. Shutterfly on the 30th, also a loss of 89 cents. We have Yelp coming out. Anyway, take a look at the whole list that we have up on the site on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And other than that, we'll see you next week. I thank you so much for joining me. Any questions you have, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.